Welcome to Relevant Parties by Carhartt Work in Progress. I'm Chelle Ravens, and in this series, I'm going behind the scenes at some of the world's best independent record labels to meet the visionaries and the obsessives who've made musical history. In each episode, we sit down with one of these label founders to find out what makes them tick. We hear the tall tales and big ideas behind some of the most influential records and scenes of the past 30 years, and maybe try to work out just what possessed them to take on one of the most challenging jobs in the music industry. One thing that unites most of the record label founders we've met on Relevant Parties is that they're not really musicians. Some of them dabble, plenty of them DJ, but more often than not, they seem to maintain a kind of awed distance from their artists, recognising perhaps that whatever talents and personal quirks make them cut out to run a label are pretty different to the ones that make you a recording artist. So with that said, cut to Adrian Sherwood, a label boss who has done things differently right from the start, paying no heed to received wisdom on who should do what and how. When he launched On You Sound just over 40 years ago, at the height of the genre mix-up that Bob Marley called the punky reggae party, he had ideas of his own about where dub should be going. So only just out of his teens, he got behind the mixing desk and gave it a go. Within a few years, Sherwood had put out a dozen or so records that still stand as some of the most groundbreaking and genre-agnostic dub recordings ever made. From acts like Creation Rebel, African Head Charge, Singers and Players, Dub Syndicate, The Missing Brazilians, New Age Steppers, and Tackhead. Well, who are they? A lot of the time, all of these bands were the same musicians, drummers and bassists like Style Scott and Doug Wimbish, Jamaican exports like Bim Sherman and Bonjo Ayabingi Noah, punk singers like Ari Up from The Slits and Mark Stewart from The Pop Group, total wildcards like the free saxophonist Lowell Coxhill and New York punks Annie Anxiety and Judy Nylon, and even multiple appearances from the dub icon to rule them all, Lee Scratch Perry. But ultimately, everything that appears on On You Sound is an Adrian Sherwood record. Right from the start, he had a vision for every sound, every bassline, which he'd sometimes hum to his bassist as a starting point. And as a renegade producer, he steered the label from one innovation to the next. From a vision of psychedelic Africa, to industrial hip-hop sample collage, to intergenerational dubstep with Bristol's Pinch. So what I have to get across is that there are a lot of records in the On You catalogue, and an incredible proportion of them are essential. You need to go and listen to them, it's that simple. To me, they capture a really important moment, just after punk had blown down the walls of the record business with the first independent labels, and after dub had transfigured the producer's studio into an instrument in its own right. That germinal moment is really at the core of every label that we've covered on this series so far. On You Sound just got there a little bit earlier. There's a lot to cover, we do get through a bit of it, but there is plenty more out there if you're ready to go down the rabbit hole. And of course, you can check out our bespoke On You Sound playlist on Spotify for a taster. So I called Adrian from his home in Ramsgate, a little seaside town in the east of England, where we laughed about his total rejection of computer technology, including Zoom, which he downloaded for the first time to do this interview, making him possibly the last person on earth to have to do a Zoom meeting. And we talked about how reggae's concept of versions upends the usual ideas of songwriting and ownership, and how London has changed since his squatting days with Ari Up and Nena Cherry. Going back to London in the late 70s, it's such a mythologized time, I suppose. And to me, I think On You Sound sort of represents something that was happening culturally, not just as like a label, but almost as a kind of artistic environment in a sense. And one that I think is very alien, certainly to me, in terms of how I think of London now, where London culture is basically just like shopping and restaurants and things, or it was before lockdown. So I wonder if you could just kind of clue me in to like what your life was at the end of the 70s when you were, I guess, squatting. I mean, basically, I want to know what the squat was like. give me a little sense of what your actual life was like at that point.
Basically, I was living in High Wycombe in Buckinghamshire, which is, I was born in London, but I went to school in Berkshire, in Slough, and then High Wycombe, because my dad had died when I was very little. My mum ended up moving around and then got married, and I ended up in High Wycombe. So I came to London again when I was about 19, 20, and I was renting a place. And then in when I was 20, I met Harry Up. When I was 21, the Slits, Harry and the Slits invited our band to Croatian Rebel with Prince Hammer to tour with them on their album launch tour to promote their debut album. And I didn't really know her before the tour, but she'd been at our gigs, so I rephrase it. And we became really good friends, and I started going around her house, and I met John Lydon, who is Harry's stepfather, I suppose you could say. He's married to Nora, and I think Nora wanted to get Harry out of the house. I don't like to say this, but she ended up one day saying, because I had a little room in Notting Hill in Goulbourne Road there, a little, you know, cheap flat room in a shared place. And her mum opened up the squat, Nora did. She used to zip around Battersea on her roller skates. And in those days, if you didn't have anywhere to live, there were lots and lots of empty places. You could buy a house, you know, in London for 20, 25 grand, you know. For nothing. It was incredible. But it was completely different times. Interest rates were very high. There were social economic problems, as there always will be, because they tend to create them. And a lot of people I knew, my friends, had squatted. I wasn't like some big squatting champion, but Harry said, oh, Nora's captured a house, you know, come and stay at the house. So I went there with Junior, my friend, who ended up fathering the twins that Harry had, Pablo and Pedro, and also Nena Cherry, who was in Harry's care, kind of. She came, she's like 16 or something, 15, 16, and her parents let her stay there as well, which was quite mad. So for several months we had this this squat. That was, but that background to the 70s with how things were, it was very exciting, because the music industry, I suppose, started in the 50s, really, you know, for teenagers anyway, because prior to that, teenagers didn't have a lot of disposable income. Mm. Suddenly, they aspired to own all these great new records being made, go to the gigs that were happening. And by the time the 70s came, you'd had previously to that, like, a lot of bands playing in pubs, or superstar bands playing in big venues, and everyone was just, like now, just trying to get noticed. And I'd come from the reggae world, where parties had to be held because of the racism and difficulty. They'd be in houses, or they'd hire a town hall, have a sound system dance. And it was kind of pioneer times, because a lot of people hadn't done tours of Holland. I was involved doing one of the very earliest tours of reggae in Holland with our Dutch partners we work with, called Midnight Records, Roy Lemmer and his crew, and David and Ricardo. And with Prince Faro, we went there when I was like 20 or something like that, you know. And prior to that, there wasn't really a network. So London at the time, a lot of people squatting, not easy to get work, not easy to get noticed. But there were lots and lots of record shops, and lots of very cool record shops, specialist shops doing soul music, Record Corner, Ballam, reggae shops everywhere. And suddenly there started a whole thing of people being able to put their own music out. And that was where it got very exciting, with the Rough Trade starting, which was heralding a whole new beginning for me, where you'd go in there and these wonderful white people, because I've been doing lots of white people, wasn't black, white, but these wonderful people were paying you as you went through the door with your boxes of records. And I met Daniel Miller. I'd go in there and there'd be the Smiths, or Mark E. Smith from The Fall, or different, you know, the Raincoats, or this heat. There'd be different people inside this building, all mixing, selling their wares. Daniel was selling his first record out the back of his car where he lived at his mum's. And we were selling reggae, and it was a meeting point, and very, very healthy time for me, very exciting. And I mean, social history wise, I could rabbit on a bit, but it was, you know, I wasn't planning to get all the different people together as I did with On You. It's just I started meeting all these great people from different backgrounds, and lots of them wanted to get involved or you know, immersed in the reggae world because they loved it. And for me, it was brilliant meeting people from different areas who had different instruments they played and a different outlook on sonic, you know, an approach to distortion overloads that weren't present in reggae, and which is where I, which what I'd been immersed in. And bit by bit, I got to meet, you know, countless brilliant people, and people were squatting. Very few owned their own place. Lots of them had come from Bristol. They were living near the nearest train station, Paddington, West London. Other people had come from other Scotland, everywhere. London was and is, you know, very multiracial, and also it's everyone's capital. People were coming from Cheltenham, like I said, Scotland, the northeast, and I'm just very glad I lived for that period because it was very exciting.
Tell me a bit about the role of reggae in that culture then, because I suppose, like I say, I mean, that period in London's history is often mythologized as a punk era, but a lot of the punks were listening to reggae, right? So I guess when you were actually involved in that scene, I mean, it must have felt as though you were kind of, I don't know, onto something a bit secret or a bit better. Was it still quite kind of a niche thing, that like a sort of an avant-garde thing in a sense?
Well, I never thought of reggae as avant-garde or anything at all. I just, I grew up at school and we were listening to Motown, James Brown, and all the pop records, you know, Rod Stewart, Gary Glitter. it was like, you know, every you know, we were into everything. And then the reggae started coming. And I just got so into all this mad, firstly, the kind of crazy stuff, the rude reggae records, then the gimmicky ones, then the songs, then the dub version, then dub. And at school, my friends were into like Pink Floyd, or other people were telling me, oh, listen to Yes, or listen to Love, or listen to whatever it is. And I was like, geez, it's horrible. I didn't like it, you know. And some of them, I'm sure they were pretending to like it, even though they didn't. But a few of us were hardcore fans of black music, really. I used to travel to Luton, to Dunstable, to the California Ballrooms and watch some of the great soul artists ever. And then I travel downstairs to the Devil's Den, and then we stayed at friends' houses in Luton to Jamaican house parties and blues parties. The same in the town I grew up in. I used to go to house parties and blues parties in High Wycombe. And before you know it, you're addicted to it. And when we came to London and all the other music was going on, everybody was curious. People were, reggae fans weren't going, oh, I want to go and hear, you know, Throbbing Gristle or perhaps the Sex Pistols or something, but or the Jam. But a lot of the people, like the same venues, they put the same shows on. So the 100 Club is a good example, which was where we did lots of our shows. We'd play, there was an old couple, Ron and Nanda, and they promoted Thursday nights. And my friend actually from High Wycombe, he did Tuesday nights. So we could go in there anytime we wanted. And Tuesday night was punk night. You go in there on a reggae night, there would be Johnny Rotten would be in there listening to the reggae. He certainly wouldn't have gone to the, you know, to the Tuesday night events. I remember the Vortex was like really, you know, Sham 69, whatever. And I remember one night they pulled out of the gig and it's like, can you come down there and do a show with Jar Whoosh? So we did a show, a reggae show, in front of a completely hostile crowd who were respectful enough not to try it on with Jamaican lads. But it was funny, the kind of cross fertilization and people playing on the same stages together. That's what kind of happened.
So as the story goes, you were you were pretty involved pretty young. You were already distributing records specifically. You'd become a funnel for records coming from Jamaica, and you were selling them in shops around the UK, right? So you were deeply involved in a sort of DIY network, I guess.
We were also manufacturing our own records in England and distributing other labels manufactured in England.
Right.
And we imported some as well from Jamaica.
Right, okay. I mean, it's honestly quite hard for me to imagine how you would organise all of these things, like without email or without whatever. You must have been extremely busy, basically. I was also thinking, just on a practical level, I mean, I've read about the fact that you basically organised the Prince Farai record to come out in the UK, right? How does that happen, though? How do you actually end up on the phone, maybe, to Prince Farai saying, yeah, we'll sort this out? Like, how did you get from a kid who wants to kind of get involved in stuff to actually being like the liaison between these kind of amazing new Jamaican records coming out?
Well, I worked with some older Jamaicans. Like the person nearest to a father I ever had was called Joe Farquharson. Joe died a couple of years ago, and he basically shaped my life. He had a club in High Wycombe called the Newlands Club, or the Twilight Club, which is actually where David Rodigan started his first ever DJ event as well. But that was years after we'd started. You know, I started there in 71 when I was 13. I think Rodigan played there in 79, when he's been quite a lot. He's quite a lot older than me, but Joe had previously worked for Palmer Records in the 60s, which is a big reggae label, and Jamaican owned. And I knew the Palmer family through Joe from being 13, 14, 15, and they gave me work in my summer holiday. And eventually I ended up working for the Palmers, and we started with another Jamaican friend called Chips. We started a reggae label, and it was through them. It wasn't because I was phoning up somebody immediately, but I made the contacts. And even to this day, it's how good your phone book is and how many people you know and who you can call. Because I'm today making some music in the studio, and we're doing stuff online. I'm able to phone my friend Gowdy in London to do some keyboards, Doug Wimbish in America, or Keith LeBlanc. And last week we had Horace Andy voicing and finishing an album in Jamaica. This is the modern world. In the old days, you couldn't do that. So you'd be hustling for studio time, waiting for cheap studio, waiting for the right man or woman to arrive to do an overdub or a vocal. But it worked, you know, everything worked. You just use your time differently, and we're much more focused on what you actually had to do with the manoeuvres you had to get people organised.
So you had a couple of label projects before On You itself got started, right? So there was Carib Gems and 4D Rhythms.
Yeah, firstly, I had a company called Carib Gems. I was a junior partner, and I selected a lot of the stuff. It started out as a roots label. And one of the tapes I selected was the Prince Farai's debut album, Psalms. And then we met.
Right.
We didn't get it from him. We got that from a chap called Pete Weston, who's a big Micron music in Jamaica. And then I met Prince Farai in Birmingham. And that's another whole story. But we got on very well. And after my first ventures went wrong, Carib Gems and our distribution company, I was still only 19. And I'd already done 2 years trying to run a label and trying to run a distribution company. And then I started one called Hit Run with my friend Pete Stroud, Dr. Pablo. And we made a couple of albums in England, almost for a laugh, but John Peel, bless him, he loved one of them, and it got me started as a producer. The other things I licensed, and after a couple of years of more of licensing, up until the last thing I licensed, I was 21. I thought, I don't really want to do this anymore. It's too much grief dealing with nutcases. Not all of them, some of them the most delightful people, but having people, you know, phoning you up saying, come on, you'll do this, you want to do this. It's like, you know what? I think I can actually make a living making tunes for myself. And that spurred me and gave me the confidence, you know, really thanks to John Peel, Steve Barker and people like that. Other great old friend of mine, longest running radio show in the country, they encouraged me and said, "Oh, we like the records you made yourself," and I just bluffed and blundered my way along. That's how I started. You know, I didn't know what I was doing.
So by the time you had On You Sound, did you feel like you had a specific vision for it? Because you're obviously still very young and you didn't necessarily have that much experience, but you must have felt that you knew what your taste was and why that was different to other people's in some way.
Well, On You started, by the time On You started, I'd met the Slits, I'd met John Lydon, I'd met Keith Levine, I'd actually met Wobble as well, you know, the Pill lot, briefly at, with Jumbo at Virgin Records, and various other people, the Raincoats. I'd met lots and lots of people at Rough Trade Shop, Daniel Miller, on and on and on, non-reggae people. And when On You started, the biggest influence on me really was Mark Stewart, the pop group singer, who I went on to work with quite a lot. And I'd loved reggae gimmicky stuff and silly records, but by then I was studying great songwriters. You know, obviously, Bim Sherman, I was a huge fan of, great songwriter. Bob Marley, Gregory Isaacs is a great songwriter. Joe Higgs, Pablo Moses, Bob Andy, on and on and on. They were all really good songwriters. And I wasn't making records, I want to have a hit, or I want to be successful. I honestly didn't care at all. I just wanted to do good work that had, even if it was instrumental, had some political thing about it, just by the way it was put together and it's sonic and how we did it. But all the songs on the label most of them, we attempted to put out A, original stuff, although the first release was a cover of the great Junior Biles song, and develop our own sound. Well, I wanted to get my own sound because it would put you in good stead, but also always attempting to record, if we did lyrics, vocals, something challenging and positive and good lyrics.
So pretty quickly, you were doing a lot of stuff in the studio in terms of controlling the broader vision, I guess, but by bringing people in to perform those, you know, various sort of tasks and creating collectives and so on. Can you tell me a bit about the very early days of actually being in the studio and going from, you know, finding records, selling records, being at the label side to suddenly being in the studio more? What was your kind of learning curve in terms of learning how to mix?
What I did, quite simply, was to make the decision, firstly, that I didn't want to license other people's music and try and run a label, because I wasn't particularly good at it. So I thought what I was going to do was produce music, use the name On You Sound, which was someone I worked with called Brady. He came up with the name, which was a play on the words of onus or very important, whatever. And we said, okay, let's go with that. Let's start doing some productions and hopefully place them with bigger labels. This was how it started. I put the first record out and I thought I had the help of Rough Trade, but Jeff Travis didn't want to do the second album or the third one. So I was suddenly left high and dry and in quite bad financial shape, owing money from my previous ventures. And it was a lot of money, to be honest. So what I did, I started getting credit off recording studios, credit off record presses, credit off the printers that printed the sleeves, and borrowing off Peter to pay Paul, and then doing a really bad deal with a company called Cherry Red, promising to make six albums for them for like £1,500 an album. I was spending more making the album than I was getting paid for them, and I'd lost all the rights to these bloody records, but I had to keep going. So the studio sessions themselves, I would have six multi-track tapes or seven piled up. In the room, I would have the great Steve Beresford, Bonjo from African Head Charge, Crucial Tony, there'd be Lizard, there'd be backing vocalists, other instrumentalists, a keyboard player as well, another keyboard player, all in a room. Everyone would be smoking, doing whatever, having beers from the pub in this underground studio called Berridge Street. Mark Stewart, Ari, different people, George Oban on bass, all in the room. So what I would do, I would then get one tape and overdub the percussionist on two tunes, then a second tape, overdub him on two or three. and then maybe one of the other tapes. Then it'd be the guitarist's turn. But they all had a different concept in mind. One was going to be African Head Charge, another Singers and Players. So I had a defined idea for each project and how I wanted it to sound. And I would then spice them all up by using the people, the 8 or 10 people who were just hanging around in the other room getting stoned, and then bring them in, bash them down, and try and do as much as I could in the few hours I'd blagged. And by the time I finished, I was owing 10,000 quid to one studio, 3 to another, 4 grand to a record press. And if you bear in mind, if I put all that together, I could have bought a house from the debts I was in. So I was a bit of a nervous wreck, but I didn't flinch, and I just stuck to it and kept going until I was about 25, when I was debt free.
Wow. What did it take to actually become debt free? Just actually being able to sell copies of records?
Well, we started getting a bit more popular.
Yeah.
Daniel Miller gave me a Depeche Mode remix to do.
Oh.
Which was 80, you know, one of the first ever remixes in the early 83.
Yeah, yeah.
And the money he gave me for that, which isn't huge, well, not even, you know, not vast, vast amount, but I used that to pay the deposit on a little house in East Ham at the time. And it wasn't planned, oh, I'm going to do this, it's going to be whatever. I just had these things. I knew that I wanted to make projects that I wanted to do, like a kind of, in inverted commas, psychedelic African thing with heavy percussion, big instruments. Bonjo and myself put this project together. Mark Stewart was adding the political edge, because Mark was always, hey, Adrian, check this, learn this, teaching me things. I had Ari's energy for the other projects, and then meeting people like Judy Nylon doing non-reggae things and other stuff. It just all reflected the people amongst us, you know, and I was recording them and getting the spices and flavours. It was like cooking.
Let's talk a bit about the sort of protocol, if you like, of dub and reggae, because I think that for anyone who is maybe a bit sort of less familiar or less into dub and reggae, or even a kind of beginner to it, it can be almost quite overwhelming as a more than a genre, but there's a lot going on. There's a lot of overlapping, interlocking people to learn about, studios and producers and different kind of characters and that kind of thing. I think On You Sound sort of reflects that way of working, right? And it's, you know, dub being this reversal of the way that music had been made to that point, right? So the studio itself is the instrument, and the producer, the mixer, becomes this overall architect of the sound, which is quite, now we see that as quite normal, I think, the idea that a pop producer is the person who writes the song. But that's something that you could argue that dub invented, really. And I think there's a different idea of ownership, perhaps, like the idea of overdubs, versions, rhythms, like things overlapping, existing different ways. And then the way that you were working with this kind of loose collective, where you had people who you could call on, bring in, you'd have different formations. I mean, all of that is really in opposition to how the record industry at the time was working, I guess, and maybe how the music industry would rather work. How much of that was out of circumstance, and how much of it was maybe a bit more sort of ideological?
Okay, well, with the area I came from and a lot of black music, there are rhythm sections. Like, you know, it's not like a band of mates, like, who are good, are okay, and they get this chemistry and they set the world on fire. If you look at the Jamaican history or the soul productions, Tamla Motown, they had a brilliant rhythm section, an in-house rhythm section. Booker T and the MGs, who backed Al Green, and they were a professional, brilliant rhythm section. In Jamaica, you had a lot of rhythm sections, Skin, Flesh and Bones, which was Sly Dunbar and Lloyd Parks, which they eventually become Sly and Robbie when he teamed up with Robbie. You then got Roots Radix. It goes on and on and on. But there were professional musicians that played to a very, very high standard, so the rhythms were brilliant. We in England were making a band, It wasn't a professional rhythm section to the level you had in Jamaica. So you had Aswad, Steel Pulse, we had Creation Rebel. You could go on and on and on. There are many, many great English bands, you know, the Reggae Regular, Mutumbi, and we had to find our own flavour. I kept trying to get our rhythm section as good as I could with the access to the players I had, but I was still thinking of it in terms of making a rhythm section. And the unique and great thing about reggae, what all reggae fans like, is what they call version. Because if you make one of these rhythms and they're very good, unique to Jamaican music is version. You've got remixes where you've got lots of different versions of a song. But with what we all love, the reggae fans, you'll have 40, 50 plus people on one rhythm, on some of the actual legendary rhythms. And people always want to hear another interpretation or version of that rhythm. And dub was just one of those things. So rather than the whole rhythm, it'd be stripped down to an instrumental version, which is how it started, and then on and on. So me in England, I was thinking, well, if I make these good enough, I can use them two or three times. I could put Ari on it, Mark could sing on it, we could put a melodica on it and have another version. But I didn't do it as well as obviously they do it there. So ours were a bit whatever. But we used some of the drum tracks a couple of times. We did have versions. I had three versions, four or five versions of some of our rhythms. And that doesn't, I still can't understand why if you've got a great track, you know, from the States, they haven't got five people on the same track. They haven't usually because of money, because of lawyers and because of things like that. But the one thing that reggae fans will always want is more cuts or more of what they love. And I tried to do that when I was making the rhythms. I tried to make them of a certain standard. That's what I was trying to do. Or make it so that nobody could copy what we were doing and things like that. I was a bit ego mad at the time. I think, right, we can change the world. We can change the world, you know. But when you're 22, 23, you need to have those things or think you can do some magic.
I wanted to ask you a bit about a few sort of specific artists. So a lot of the major early On You Sound outfits were basically, as you were describing, kind of vehicles for your own ideas and different versions, right? So Creation Rebel, African Head Charge, Missing Brazilians, they're all different angles on a similar thing that you're controlling at the time, right? We could talk about all of them, but I wanted to know about African Head Charge and particularly about Bonjo and where he'd sort of come from and his lineage, because I think that's quite an interesting aspect of that period.
Well, Bonjo is from a Rasta community up in the hills in Jamaica, in Hanover, not far from where Lee Perry comes from, actually, but like a kind of remote, proper old Rasta community. He came to England. He had a few little issues when he was here. And he was a very strong man. You know, he could lift up a car. You know, he was like a kind of strong as an ox and a bit of a character. But he got into jazz and Cuban rhythms as well. And when I met him, he joined the latter stages of Creation Rebel, our band. He played in Creation Rebel for a while. And Creation Rebel was originally a studio name that I'd had. It wasn't a proper band, it became one. We developed it, Crucial Tony and myself and Lizard and Dr. Pablo. We developed it into a live band to back Prince Farai. Eventually, sadly, Lizard had to go to Her Majesty's service for some weird business. And it was the end of the band. By then, I was under so much pressure economically. I just switched into doing other things. And I'd started the Creation Rebel. I started the Singers and Players project. But what I had done right at the end of Creation Rebel, I thought, I read an interview with Brian Eno saying about he had a vision of a psychedelic Africa. And I thought, yeah, oh, that's really pretentious idiot, you know. But then I thought about it and thought, no, that's brilliant. That's a really good idea. We've got Bonjo here who loves African rhythms. I wanted to experiment. So I started by taking a drum track I had, stripping it down, copying it, playing over it, I played bass on it. I'm not even a proper bass player. I got my then wife to tune it for me. I just kind of hammered these bass lines. Bonjo played percussion, and we started experimenting, slowing down tapes, distorting things, playing things through speakers in a toilet, and made this kind of mad record, My Life in a Hole in the Ground. But it was built around Bonjo's percussion playing and the idea of having heavy rhythms. Like, if you look at Jamaican music, they don't use the great big drums or congas. They'll tend to use tiny drums like bongos or shakers. So all the chat, they were talking about Africa, Back to Africa and whatever. And they might have the Funde Naya Bingi stuff, the Rastafari thing, but they weren't really using the big drums. So we started experimenting using the big drums, and that was the beginning of the first Head Charge album, which is, it's now 40 years ago. And Bonjo, though, is, you know, he could have been a professional boxer. He could have done anything. He was like a big, strong, strong character. And Bonjo, he was Rastafarian, and he believed in, you know, the whole Garveyist Back to Africa movement. And he lives in Africa. I spoke to him yesterday. He's in a place called Botatanga in Ghana. And he's got family and, you know, kids out in Africa. And he's a great grandfather.
Wow, right. Over those years, I think one of the really impressive things about what On You were doing was achieving something like a kind of erasure of genre. Like, we keep talking about dub reggae, and obviously that is the deep affiliation. But at the same time, you were bringing so many other things in by virtue of the variety of players that you actually had on, people like Lol Coxhill or Mark Stewart, obviously. And I wanted to just mention a couple of people who I think stand out for being quite different as well, which is Judy Nylon and Annie Anxiety, who in many ways don't really fit into any of the other things that are going on, but as voices and as personalities, perhaps they did in some ways. Can you tell me a little bit about both of those two? And the Judy Nylon especially, it's one of my favourites, and I think deserves a flashier reissue bundle. I would pay a lot for that.
No, we would like to release it. I mean, she actually owns that record, and she doesn't want it to be. She doesn't want. We tried to. I said, let us release it. You have all the money. She hasn't won it. That was a bit of a messy situation. The record was financed by Virgin Music. They asked me to get involved in the production, and I worked with Judy on the production. She had a very distinctive idea. She wanted the voice right in your face. She had some great players. She introduced me to Nick Pleitas. I had some of ours, like Sean Oliver, bless him as well, great player, and brought in Chris Joyce and some other people. And I'm very pleased that record. You know what happened? I was convinced that record was going to be very successful at the time, but Virgin couldn't get a deal for it. So the man at the publishing company got us to release it. I was hoping that was going to come out on a big label, and I'd get some credit as being producer, co-producer of that record. And then I don't think Judy was happy how it all played out. And then I'd love to see that record come out again. It's not been available. Annie Anxiety, little Annie, she's like family. She's like very close. I met her at Southern Studios through the band Crass, Penny Rambo, Pete, Steve Ignorant and everybody. And she was one of their artists. And my friend John Loder, who ran Southern Studios, he asked if I'd produce a record with her. And that's how, so we ended up doing two or three albums together.
Yeah, and just for clarity, for anyone who isn't familiar with either of those, the reason that they're related in some sense is because they come from a sort of downtown New York punk scene type of milieu, and two American women singers on the label, which just is this kind of nice contrast with everything else that's going on. And they bring something that's quite, you know, they're not the same voice, but they have a certain kind of raw bluesy energy, I guess, both of them, a punk energy. Quite soon after that then, or maybe it's all around the same time, you meet Keith LeBlanc, who is about to join you in Tackhead. And to me, it seems that around this time, which I guess is sort of 84-ish, the label takes a different direction somehow. It's like a little bit of a reboot in some way. And the Tackhead records, again, I mean, I've had a lot of fun researching this particular conversation, but I do love the Tackhead records so much. And I think they've aged really well. They definitely sound of their time in a lot of ways, but they were also doing something that was so new for that time and you know, was to become really quite influential. Could you tell me about the kind of genesis of Tackhead and what it was that you were trying to do with that? Because it does seem like it was quite a definite departure from some of the other or new projects to that point.
Ironically, we've just made the first new material Tackhead record for 30 years. We've been doing it, working online. It's something mental. But that's another story. But
wow, that's exciting.
What you've got to bear in mind, I'll go back to the thing about rhythm sections. You know, Doug, Skip and Keith are a Premier League rhythm section. They played The Message, you know, Don't Push Me Because I'm Close to the Edge. They White Lines. They played all those great songs for Sugar Hill. So when I met Keith, he was it had all gone wrong at Sugar Hill. They were in court. He was in court with Sugar Hill and he wasn't very happy, to put it mildly. And he was working with Tommy Boy and he did Malcolm X No Sellout. He did that tune. And I told him I'd been running a label since I was 17 and he couldn't believe it. And we got on well. I went to the studio with him in New York and watched him playing for Sylvain, or was it Edgar Winter or something? He was doing some session for Tommy. And I thought, oh, wow, he's nuts. And then I heard his programming and then I said, do you want to, you know, come to England for a laugh? And he come over and he and I did the first record together. And then he introduced me to Doug and Skip and we started backing Mark Stewart on some gigs, doing our own thing on the gigs and basically evolved. And I don't know if you've heard Major Malfunction, but it's a Keith LeBlanc, but that's a Tackhead record as well, basically. We you know, that for a 4-year, 5-year period there, we were really doing some very, very out there stuff.
When I first discovered Tackhead, I was quite struck by how it seemed to anticipate a lot of things that were kind of on the cusp of happening in other genres as well. Like Public Enemy, it made me think of so much, you know, that News on the Beat, that is a decent enough description of what they were doing as well. So later on in the 80s, I was kind of curious about how you felt when the kind of acid house moment came in 1988 and how the label fit in with rave as it arrived. Because there's a kind of interesting turning point into the 90s as dub and dub reggae become attached to the rave movement in a certain, perhaps sort of unexpected way. What did you make of acid house when it arrived? Like, were you still going out by that point?
I was, yeah. I used to go every few weeks. I'd go out to Dungeons, which was like a club on Leabridge Road. It was like a brilliant club. My friend Leo would go down there and it was like everybody was cuddling each other. It was actually brilliant because you'd had a lot of the football violence and trouble in the 80s. Heisel and there was, you know, Thatcher was trying to, you know, I should have liked to have closed football down, amongst other things. It was evil, but it was like leprosy. And then suddenly, you know, there was a lot of football violence and things that happened. Suddenly along came rave music and ecstasy, and it was actually one of the most enlightening times probably since the 60s. It was revolutionary. It was great. For me, I didn't want to suddenly start. I did quite a lot of dance tunes and I had a few successes, a couple of chart hits with Human Nature and another couple of tunes. And I did quite a few mixes. But for me, listening to boof, 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 boof for 8 hours on one song trying to do it. In hindsight, I wish I'd actually ventured in it a bit more and grabbed myself a bit of money, but I just couldn't bear it. So I stuck to my gun still and kept doing African Head Charge, kept doing a bit more left field stuff. But I did intersperse it with a few things that were semi-successful. And a lot of people approached me to work with them, which I should have done. Again, worked with a lot of great artists that I didn't. But I really believed that what I was doing, or what we were doing, our crew, was going to be 10 times more successful than it was. Like an idiot, I stuck to my guns. But I'm not really. I think it's good because in hindsight, you could probably become really successful doing something that your heart and soul isn't into. And then you're left as a shell because you've emptied everything out.
Yeah, absolutely.
In something that's not yours, you know.
But there were a few records in that period that seemed to sort of strike a chord, maybe in slightly unexpected ways, like Dub Syndicate becoming a kind of chill out album, a kind of ambient room album. That it's interesting how some aspects of dub reggae kind of found new sort of functions within a rave scene, I guess.
Well, Stoned Immaculate was like the a massive album on the rave scene, and people loved it. And you know, we were still getting you know, the Head Charge, the Songs of Praise, and Shashamani as it went into the 90s. You know, I know that a lot of people were influenced by us, and every time I met some really good artists, and they said, "Oh, you know, Adrian, you know, really, the label really influenced me, or this was really good." That made me feel really, really great anyway. I wasn't even, you know, I was making records for us, and I just tried to stick to my guns. And a couple of times with my life collapsing a bit, it all went wrong a little bit. The beginning of the 90s, and then in the mid-90s as well, I had a couple of pretty bad periods, and you have to kind of regroup yourself. That's how it goes.
What did you think about that sort of period musically, though? Because I was thinking a little bit about the way that, you know, by the time you got further into the 90s, you'd have proper kind of like free party type people, white dreadlocks or whatever, being into something like Revolutionary Dub Warriors. And then, you know, I can't help but notice that one of your own records is called Never Trust a Hippie. And I just wondered if you've felt any sort of you know, antagonism between newer people who were taking up music who were definitely not punks, or perhaps it had come full circle in some way.
Well, I don't. I mean, I'm not very judgmental. If I fell out with somebody, whatever, or they pissed me off, it's not worth holding. It's like, I'm not judgmental. If somebody wants to dress or do whatever, as long as they're not hurting anybody, it's like, cool, entertain me, let me watch the show. With the white dready thing, whatever, why not? It didn't bother me at all. I would never have dreadlocks because I'm bald, and I wouldn't have had them if I could, nor anymore would I talk in a fake Jamaican accent. But if somebody wants to, that's their business, you know. I could understand people were trying to get involved, relate to it, and it was always people could drop out in the 60s. You can't drop out anymore. Unless you go to Wales, maybe. Sorry, no, I love Wales, but you can't. Where do you drop out now? A lot of people, you know, were going on the road, the travelling. You know, there was some of those communities then in that period you're talking, the rave, post-rave scene, was very, very healthy, and the fact they might have had dreadlocks didn't bother me in the least, to be honest. I just I met some of the nicest, loveliest people you could ever meet.
Why is it that you should never trust a hippie then? You said it.
Well, the hippies, really. I found the hippies were more like the kind of record company people, the Richard Bransons or who were like, hey, man, you know, let's help you, man, you know. And like, I saw that at, you know, places. And, you know, you put so much hope in, you know, I saw something like Rough Trade, to me, was like the answer. It was absolutely brilliant, the model. But then other people want to be rich, and you know, certain people in organisations, and then other great people get trodden on, and then, you know, somebody, you know, like masquerading as like a kind of you know, a hippie, nice kind of person, and you're in fact like a breadhead. You know, it's like hey, whatever. It was a comment John Lydon made, and I thought it was really good. Never trust a hippie. And my mate Bob and me were chatting. He said, oh, that'd be quite an amusing name, because our record came out on Real World. Hey, we thought, put an album out called Real World, through Real World, call it Never Trust a Hippie. And I actually love Peter Gabriel. He's a great bloke. He's done a lot for music. Total respect. But it was, for the reasons I said, and also it kind of tickled my sense of humour.
Yeah, so you went back to Solar Records in, this century, and you've collaborated with Pinch a couple of times as well. I was wondering a little bit about creativity for you when it comes to making your own records. Has your creativity been like a constant stream of activity for you? Like, do you keep up with doing creative things even if you're not releasing records, or do you kind of need to wait for something a bit more, waiting for inspiration to strike a little bit?
I'm not a musician. I'm in the orthodox sense at all. I play a mixing desk. I make noises. I like organizing things and doing stuff. So I've gone through periods when you feel, to be honest with you, you don't feel at your best, and you can go through the motions. Doing a gig is a different thing to actually coming and hitting some sparks when you're making music. At the moment, I feel like I'm in a very good position. The last few things I've done, I did a lovely album with my daughter, Denise. I don't know if you've heard that. I did a lovely album with Lee Perry a couple of years ago. Very, very proud of that. Rainford and Heavy Rain. And I've currently got some, the last Pay It All Back was a little taster, but I've got a few records. I'm going to get ready to hit the ground running after I'm allowed out of my big brother cell here to go and do some stuff. And, you know, I'm going to keep making tunes till I drop and haven't got anything else to do and anything else to offer. But it's just, I'm just very glad I've gone through each of these decades you've talked about, because each one's got something. I can see how when the reggae was blown away by Sleng Teng, I can see when the rave music scene came, you know, with the acid house, then with bands, you know, the Weatherall's impact on dance music, the impact of DJs, you know, Oki and Weatherall and Steve and all those guys, the impact they had on guitar bands, and then the development into jungle and the evolution of bass music. I've been there watching it all. But I didn't want to try and jump into anybody else's boots, you know. So if I did anything, the collaboration with Pinch was a very normal, good idea, because here I was working, as I had with the Roots Radix rhythm section with Style, or with the Sugar Hill rhythm section. Here I was working with a person who was great in the area he'd come from, the school, the dubstep school, and he and I tried to do something that, again, I thought would sell 10 times more than it did. But although I'm very proud of it, I thought it would, but I think it fell between two stools. I think that perhaps didn't quite fit in my era or his. But I'd stand by those records and say I'm very proud of them. But sod it, you know, you have to, if you're making music to try and make money, you're going to have a short life. If you make stuff and you do what you like yourself, you might have a chance of, I've lost the duration.
Just another thing about the legacy then. I think obviously the arrival of dubstep was probably one entryway for a lot of people into Odd New Sound, for sure.
Pinch or...
But going back to actually the original dubstep era, I'm sure that may have been a way for people to go back and discover dub and Odd New Sound as well. And I'm sure that you were probably, you know, following the development of other, you know, dub and bass cultures of jungle and dubstep and, you know, the kind of lineage. And I also was thinking about so when Trevor Jackson did the Science Fiction Dance Hall collection, which kind of put a spotlight on this particular seam of Odd New Sound records that kind of connected up this like particular kind of, you know, dance floor thing that you could pick up on multiple records. And I think that was probably a big thing again for a new generation discovering Odd New Sound. Definitely a big record for me to discover the catalogue when it came out. I wondered, like, does it ever surprise you the way that other people hear the legacy or the way that other people think of it, I guess?
Does, yeah. I mean, I would never have released that record. I mean, bless him, Trevor. No, Trevor, you know, to me it was a lot of kind of stuff I just like, wasn't even on my radar.
Wow.
Because when I made stuff, I seldom play it. So play it so much when it's done, I'll then play it out on gigs, and then I won't play it for 25 years, 20
Sick
years. and then somebody suddenly says, oh, I really like that tune. Or if I go out and I hear something, I think, I recognise that. And you realise it was something you've done. It's quite amusing, but I wouldn't have done it. So I'm really glad Trevor did that, because it's somebody coming in with a different... Or Patrick Doctor, my friend, who's been listening to things, oh, I love that, and do this. It's like, all right. And you give trust to somebody to kind of reintroduce you from a completely out of your safety zone, different thing that you choose yourself.
Final question then. I just wanted to ask a little bit about Ramsgate, because you have been, you know, you don't just live there sort of in some semi-retirement. Like, it's a really active music town, I guess. Tell us about it.
Well, I moved down here because my youngest daughter, she was here and she was young. And I thought, if I haven't got that time with her, it's gone. And I was going through a bit of a bad time in my life. This was 11 years ago. She's since, last couple of years ago, she's left here and she's living in Muswell Hill and she's had a baby. So I'm down here on my own and I couldn't afford to move. But I love Ramsgate. Ramsgate's great. But since I came here, a lot of my friends have been to visit and they moved down here. So because of Emily, my daughter, there's a lot of people now call here home. So Congo Natty, he came to visit. He and his family, his lovely family, they live here. Ghetto Priest, Skip McDonald, Ashley Beadle, Clem Bushy, the great man produced Tapazuki's Manor Warrior, and he basically one of the inventors of Lover's Rock. He lives 200 yards from me. Adamski, 50 yards from us. There's more, I'm forgetting lots. Bobby Marshall, who looks after me and worked with me and Asian Dub Foundation. One of my best friends, Leo, he's down here as well. We've got a lot of very, very healthy people. And then just down the road, we've obviously got Margate, and that's full of DFLs, they call them here, down from Londoners. Then up the road, you've got Broadstairs, which is like a more of a retirement place for the older ones.
It should be explained that all these places are seaside towns. I think you could call them faded seaside towns. I don't think that would be unfair, but charming in their own way. And I just wanted to touch on one other thing which I discovered had happened in Ramsgate some time ago. I expect it probably won't happen again, but what was Shantytown in Ramsgate?
Oh, great. Well, Shantytown, we're very proud of it. My friend Nigel Askew, who owns the Queen Charlotte pub, which is a very great pub, and we had some incredible nights there. But several years ago, maybe 8 years ago now, we started Shantytown, and we had the lease on these massive arches to fit 250 plus people in down on the seafront, and we had no electric and no running water. They were the storage areas for a club called Nero's, but they're like, you know, very, very old, and we decorated it up, put generators in there, put loos in there, all with no electricity, and we put a dozen or so events on only. But being in a reggae sound system, I'd be DJing, and I've had Mungo's, Dennis Bavell, I've had Ito Horns, Daddy Freddy, Pinch, on and on. I've had some incredible nights there, and it was legendary status in Ramsgate. The council eventually, just last year, evicted us from there. they took it away from us. But we didn't do that many, but the ones we did, it looked like a cross between an 18th century inn and a massive blues dance. It was very, very special. And, you know, we might try again, but it's putting anything on with councils and bureaucracy is tough. But we'll rebrand Shantytown and probably put some events on in another venue on a bigger scale.
Excellent. This is what I want to hear at the moment. I want to hear people planning, blue sky thinking for this roadmap out of lockdown or whatever. That would be exciting. Adrian, thank you very, very much for that quick tour through On You Sound.
There's
so much more we could have covered, but thank you so much. You've been listening to Relevant Parties from Carhartt Work in Progress. If you want to dive into more music from the labels in this series, check out the Relevant Parties playlist on Spotify. You can find the link in the show notes. And remember, you can subscribe to Relevant Parties so that you never miss an episode. It's available wherever good podcasts are found. And if you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to leave a rating and a comment on Apple Podcasts. We'd really love to know what you think. So thanks for listening, and join me next time for more stories behind the world's best record labels. We'll be right back.